We want to be crowded very closely or touched. Even in community spaces, where we can't necessarily control who enters our personal space, we have a choice. We have the right not to be there. In romantic relationships, we have to negotiate shared physical space, especially when we live with a lover. If touch, for us, begins beyond our skin, we may need to negotiate some space that we can control. For some people, this may be a room of our own. For some, it might be as simple as asking for quiet time on the couch. If you don't have the ability to negotiate for individual space when you need it, coercion has entered your relationship. You may always set boundaries about your physical space and your body. If someone ever tells you it's not okay to assert a physical boundary, especially regarding who you will have sex with or who is allowed to touch you, look out. There's a problem. Your mind is your mental and emotional experience of the world, your memories, your reality, and your values. When you engage the world, you let people into this mental space. Finding the edges of your mind is trickier than finding your physical edges. We are social creatures, and even the most superficial interactions engage our mental and emotional boundaries. The boundaries of the mind are both ones we most control and the ones easiest for others to cross. When we engage in intimate relationships, we open up our mental boundaries. We let a chosen few affect us deeply. This is beautiful and amazing, and one of the things that makes life worth living. But your mind always belongs to you, and you alone. Your intimate partners, your family, your boss, and the woman at the grocery store only ever get your mind on loan. And if that intimacy is damaging you, you have the right to take it back. Always. That means we all have a fundamental, inalienable right not to extend ourselves emotionally to anyone we don't choose to. Every one of us has the absolute right to choose whom we will or will not be intimate with, for any reason or no reason. Setting mental boundaries is different from setting physical boundaries. When you set a physical boundary, you are exerting clear control over what you do with your body. Don't touch me there, for example. Don't move closer to me. Leave my home. With emotional boundaries, we have to take care not to make others responsible for our mental state. When we tell another person, "Don't say or do things that upset me," we are not setting boundaries. We are trying to manage people whom we have already let too far over our boundaries. If we make others responsible for our own emotions, we introduce coercion into the relationship, and coercion erodes consent. When we talk about setting boundaries, we're not talking about restrictions on another's behavior, except as their behavior regards access to you. Of course, whether you choose to grant that access may in fact depend on how they are behaving. Examples of boundaries include: I will not be involved with someone who is not open and honest with all other partners about dating me. I will not have unbarriered sex with partners whose sexual behavior does not fall within my level of acceptable sexual health risk. I will not become involved with someone who is not already committed to polyamory. I will not remain in a relationship with a partner who threatens me or uses violence. I will choose the level of closeness I want with my partners, other partners, subject to their consent. The difference between boundaries we set for ourselves and rules we place on someone else might seem like one of semantics, but it is profound. Rules tend to come from the idea that it's acceptable or even desirable for you to control someone else's behavior, or for someone else to control yours. Boundaries derive from the idea that the only person you really control is yourself. Sacrificing yourself. One way to damage a relationship is to believe that your sense of self or self-worth comes from your partner or being in a relationship. If you constantly seek reinforcement of your worth from your partner becomes your source of worth, rather than your equal. This kind of codependence is exhausting for your partner and destructive for you. This is especially likely to happen if you have trouble setting boundaries. Fuzzy boundaries can lead to a loss of self-identity and an inability to tell where yourself and your responsibility to set your own boundary ends and your partner begins. Losing your self-identity opens you up to being manipulated or losing your ethical integrity. And you must be true to yourself if you are to be true to those you love. When you feel that you need a relationship, you may become afraid to raise your voice and assert the other things you need. It's hard to set boundaries in a relationship you feel you can't live without, because setting boundaries means admitting there are things that might end your relationship. Here's Eve's story.
I was probably 11 or 12 when I began believing that my worth was tied to a relationship. As a teenager, my favorite heroine was Eponine from Les Miserables. Her death from taking a bullet for the man she loved was one of the most romantic things I could imagine. I loved, and still love, Oscar Wilde's short story, The Nightingale and the Rose, in which a nightingale gives her life to help a boy woo the object of his adoration, who rejects him anyway. So when I began to accept, 10 years ago, give or take, that relationships were actually supposed to be fulfilling for me, that laying my own needs and even my own personality at the feet of a partner was not actually a noble or desirable thing, the idea was a game-changer. It nearly ended my marriage, twice, and I still struggle with it. Which is why I needed this poem, by Franklin's sweetie Maxine Green, which I coincidentally discovered online just a few months before I met and began dating Franklin. I give, and you give, and we draw lines in ourselves where we stop. I draw a line here. Do you see it? It's the place just before it hurts me to give. Because I know, if you love me, if you love the way I do, this is where you would beg me to stop. That poem, and some other things that happened to me around that time, helped me realize that loving someone or giving to someone is not supposed to hurt. And if it does, something is wrong. But drawing that line can be so, so hard. And on those occasions when I must do so, often the repercussions resonate at the same frequency as my own guilt and self-judgment until they shake the foundation of my convictions. For me, self-sacrifice is conditioning that goes very, very deep.
One form of sacrificing the self is embedded in the many versions of the fairy tale. There are many toxic myths about love, but perhaps the worst is that love conquers all. This myth hurts us in all kinds of ways, such as the untold zillions of hours and wasted tears spent by people trying to heal, reform, or otherwise change a partner. Especially pernicious is the idea that we're supposed to give until it hurts. In fact, for some of us, that the measure of our worth is our ability to give, right down to the last drop of ourselves. That is wrong. Love isn't supposed to hurt, and we should not and do not need to sacrifice ourselves for good relationships. Boundaries versus rules. For a person accustomed to passive communication, see chapter 6, the difference between a boundary and a rule may not be clear. A passive communicator may impose restrictions on a partner by stating the restriction as a boundary, using I will boundary language when she is actually implying you will restrictions. The difference is in what happens if the other person doesn't behave as desired. For example, consider a reasonable boundary. You are free to do what you like with your body, with other people. I am free to decide my level of acceptable risk to my sexual health. If you engage in behavior that exceeds my level of risk, I reserve the right to use barriers with you, or perhaps not to have sex with you at all. If this is a boundary, and the other person has sex that exceeds your level of risk, you assess the situation, and you take appropriate action. You might, for instance, say, since you are not choosing to use barriers with this other partner, I will use barriers with you, and then do so. On the other hand, if this is actually a rule being stated in the language of boundaries, you may feel the other person did something he shouldn't have, or that you were entitled to make him always use safer sex barriers with others. If there is recrimination, anger, or punishment in the response to your partner's choices, then you have instituted a rule, regardless of the wording. Genuine boundaries recognize that others make their own choices, and we do not have the right or ability to control those choices. Rather, we have the right and ability to determine for ourselves what intimacy we choose to be involved in. Healthy compromise. No two people have the same needs. Whenever we tie our lives to others, especially in romantic relationship, there will be times when we can't have everything we want. The ability to negotiate in good faith and seek compromise when our needs and those of others conflict is a vital relationship skill. To understand where we can make compromises and where we can't, we must first know our own boundaries, which will limit what we can compromise on. Here's Eve's story.
In Minding the Gap, I told the story of Peter's first weekend together with Cleo at our house. Before then, I had never taken the time to consider what boundaries I might need. I was so grateful for the freedom I'd had with Ray, I wanted to be able to reciprocate all at once. Unfortunately, boundaries are not transitive. The work Peter had done to become comfortable with me and Ray did not translate into my being equally comfortable with Peter and Cleo. I lay awake for most of their first night together. I spent the next day at a seminar, but could barely focus. As the day wore on, I felt more and more anxious and more angry, but I knew Peter and Cleo had done nothing wrong. I was upset because I hadn't taken care of myself. I rushed home after the seminar and was barely through the door when I asked Peter to speak with me alone. I told him what I'd been feeling. I had 5 specific requests to make of him and Cleo. I wanted them to clean up any signs of sex, including towels left on the floor immediately afterward, before I woke up and saw them. I wanted Peter to wear a robe or other clothing when moving between my bedroom and the room he was staying in with Cleo. I wanted Peter and Cleo to shower after having sex and before coming to bed with me. We agreed after the first night to try co-sleeping. If Peter and Cleo slept with me in our bed, I wanted them both to wear pajamas or other clothing. I wanted Peter to return to bed with me before he fell asleep. We soon scuttled that last one as I grew more comfortable and Peter and Cleo's relationship deepened. I relaxed many of the others, too, over time. Now an empty condom wrapper on the floor elicits an eye roll and a smirk, at most. They were crucial, though, in the early days of Peter and Cleo's relationship, as my emotions struggled to catch up with my rational mind.
The best compromises are those that allow everyone to have their needs met in ethical, compassionate ways. For example, say you want to go on a date, but your partner wants to spend more time with your kids. A compromise might be to schedule the date for late in the evening, after you've had time to help the children with their homework and they've gone to bed. Both objectives are met. On the other hand, a compromise like agreeing not to have any other relationships until the kids have left home might be a boundary violation. If polyamory is essential to your happiness and part of your identity, this compromise requires giving up a part of who you are. With such a compromise, it's reasonable to question whether spending time with the kids has become a proxy for, I want a monogamous relationship, so I'm using concerns about the children as a pretext. When we are asked to compromise in ways that require us to give up our agency or ability to advocate for our needs, these compromises also threaten to violate our boundaries. Many parts of our lives are available for negotiation, but compromising away our agency or bodily integrity, for example, by agreeing to have sex with someone we might not want to, or agreeing to limits on what we are allowed to do with our bodies, means giving up control of our boundaries. Boundaries and single, solo, poly people. People who value autonomy highly and take a solo, poly or free agent approach to polyamory face some special considerations around boundaries. Relationships that don't follow the traditional escalator, dating, moving in together, marrying, having kids, are often perceived as less important, serious, or legitimate than traditional relationships. So, unsurprisingly, these relationships are sometimes not treated seriously, even in the poly community. Many polyamorous people still carry conventional social expectations about how relationships should look. For these reasons, free agents must state their boundaries and advocate for their needs very early on. I'm never likely to live with you, but I still consider this relationship significant, and I still want to feel free to express what I need and have you consider my needs, represents a reasonable boundary. As a single, solo poly person, you also need to be clear on the value your existing relationships have to you and what your commitment is to them, or they may be trivialized in the minds of potential partners who don't understand what commitment looks like to you. A common complaint from solo poly folks is that many people assume they're only looking for casual sex. Because society so tightly conflates sex, relationships, and life interconnection, this can be an easy mistake to make. But not wanting to move in does not necessarily mean only wanting casual sex. Negotiating boundaries around sex, particularly the expectation attached to it, is important to help solo poly people navigate the tangled thicket of assumptions that might pop up. Because solo poly people place a high emphasis on personal autonomy, things such as veto, hierarchies, and rules that constrain how the relationship is allowed to grow are especially problematic. Most solo polyamorists we have met will not enter such agreements. Ironically, people who do seek prescriptive hierarchies and look for secondary partners will often gravitate towards solo poly people, erroneously believing that if solo poly people don't want the trappings of a conventional relationship, they don't become seriously invested in their relationships. This misperception often leads to pain. The free agent model can also have a dark side, just as people who try to prescribe a specific relationship structure can misuse boundary language to control others. People who prefer a free agent model can use boundaries around their personal decision-making as a way to avoid responsibility for the consequences of what they do. The choices we make belong to us, but so do their consequences. If you emphasize personal autonomy to the exclusion of listening to your partner's needs, you're not asserting boundaries, you're being a jerk. Setting new boundaries. Early in our relationships, when everything is going well, we're inclined to overlook faults and annoyances. Our hormones are telling us that we want to become one with our partners, share everything with them, love them forever. This is when setting boundaries is the most important in order to lay a good long-term foundation, and also when we're least likely to set them. This is also when codependency can take root. Patterns laid down now can entrench over the years. Our personalities can polarize in over-functioning, under-functioning dynamics, where one partner takes care of the other, removing their agency, or other unhealthy patterns. And the boundaries around our sense of self can blur. If we get stuck in a dysfunctional dynamic and want to reclaim ourselves and re-establish a healthy relationship balance, we need to learn how to set new boundaries in old relationships. Even in perfectly healthy relationships, people can change. What was okay last year may not be okay today. When relationships are good, they make us better. They make our lives bigger, and it's easy to forget about our boundaries because there's no reason to enforce them. Yet, when communication erodes, when trust comes into question, when we feel out of control or deeply unhappy, and then we try to set a boundary, the experience can be terrifying. Setting a new boundary is a change, and change is rarely comfortable. To your partner, the change can feel non-consensual. The key with boundaries is that you always set them around those things that are yours, your body, your mind, your emotions, your time, intimacy with you. You always have a right to regulate access to what is yours. But by the time the boundaries of yourself have become blurred with those of your partner, setting boundaries and defining yourself feels like taking something away from her that she had come to regard as hers. Harriet Lerner's Dance of Intimacy, listed in the resources section of the paperback and digital version of this book, is an excellent tool for anyone needing help with setting relationship boundaries. Lerner describes the change back response that are always common when new boundaries are set. When we establish a new way of doing things, our partners work to re-establish the old, comfortable pattern. Countermoves take numerous forms, from outright denial to criticism to threats to end the relationship. The trick with countermoves is to not to try and stop them, but to allow them to happen while holding firm in the change that we have made. And if your partner is setting a new boundary, remember that he has a right to do so, even if it means he's revoking consent to things he agreed to before. The change may hurt, but the solution is not to violate the boundaries or try to talk to your partner out of them. No one should ever be punished for setting personal boundaries or for withholding or revoking consent. Pushing back gently. People rarely cross our boundaries intentionally, unless we're in an actively abusive situation. However, people sometimes cross them accidentally. Because of this, healthy boundaries need flexibility. They can't be so brittle that the slightest touch threatens to end a relationship. There must be some allowance for the fact that we are all born of frailty and error. We need to be able to accept a certain amount of push and reassert our boundaries by pushing gently back. We need to be able to say, "Hey, I prefer you not to do this thing," rather than, "You monster, how dare you?" This is a tricky balancing act because predators and abusers are skilled at probing boundaries. One of the tools of a predator is to ignore a no in small ways, testing how we respond, finding weaknesses, and choosing people who won't reassert a no. Gavin DeBecker talks about the tests a predator gives to potential targets in his book, The Gift of Fear. Protecting ourselves from those who have genuinely evil intent means being willing to reassert our boundaries or end a relationship in the face of repeated infringement. even as we allow some flexibility for unintended boundary violations, such as the ones Eve experienced early in Peter's relationship with Cleo, described earlier. Sudden left turns. Over the years, Franklin has received thousands of emails through his polyamory site. Some of these emails are heartbreaking. They might start off describing the ordinary sorts of difficulties that can happen in any poly relationship, but midway through, they suddenly veer off into wildly unhealthy, dysfunctional dynamics. Franklin has started referring to these as sudden left turn emails. They start out normally, but then take a sudden left turn into the swamp. In one such email, a woman wrote to say that she and her fiancé had always had a monogamous relationship, with no mention of polyamory. Then, after the wedding, her husband told her he felt monogamy was unnatural and harmful. As she put it, he said the idea of monogamy is even more perverted than homosexuality, and monogamous relationship cause sexuality atrophy. And he demanded that he be free to have other lovers. Another talked about a couple opening up to polyamory, in which the man told his wife, "If we do this, I only want you to have sex with other women. I don't want you to have sex with other men." As mentioned previously, it's common for men to feel threatened by other men and to seek to forbid their partners to have other male lovers. In this case, however, the woman identified as straight. Her partner demanded that she become bisexual. A common problem Franklin has received many emails about concerns someone in a poly relationship, usually a partner of a person who started dating someone new who feels insecure. Insecurity can happen in any relationship, of course. In these cases, however, the insecure partner will try to deal with the insecurity by demanding to read every email and text with the new partner, hear everything they talk about, sometimes even listening in on phone conversations, and become extremely angry at the suggestion that there might be some sort of expectation of privacy. Almost all of these emails end with, "Is this normal? If I am polyamorous, does that mean I have to accept this?" No, it isn't. And no, you don't. Polyamory is a relatively new cultural phenomenon. Our society has a great deal of experience with monogamy, so the warning signs of coercion or abuse in monogamous relationships are well known. In polyamory, however, we are blazing a new trail. Few people have significant experience in polyamorous relationships, so the warning signs of trouble may not be so clear. There are many signs of a harmful relationship dynamic, but the most unmistakable one is fear. Why am I so afraid in this relationship when there's no imminent physical danger? If you find you are asking yourself this question, check your boundaries. Do you know where they are? How much power have you given to others to affect your well-being, your self-esteem, even your desire to live? Remember, when you give someone the power to affect you and to come into your mind, you're only loaning what belongs to you. If you are afraid, you have given too much. When you look forward, do you see choices? Is leaving the relationship a viable option? Is changing the relationship a viable option? Is setting new boundaries an option? What happens if you say no? It is unnerving when a relationship becomes permeated by fear, but this is often the trajectory of a relationship that lacks consent. It starts when you begin to bend yourself around your fears instead of embracing your dreams. We see plenty of relationships fall apart in sadness, anger, hurt, and feelings of betrayal, but fear is worse. If, on the other hand, your partner has started expressing new boundaries with you, ethics and decency demand a compassionate response. Remember that people express boundaries to protect themselves, and we all have the right to do this. Access to another person's body and mind is a privilege, not a right. Nobody should ever be punished for expressing a boundary or revoking consent. Boundaries and psychological health. One place where boundaries in any romantic relationship can become especially difficult to navigate is around the issues of mental health. Each of us has the right to set whatever boundaries we want, and these include boundaries concerning partners with mental health issues. We don't always like to acknowledge this, but it's true. A person who grew up with an alcoholic parent might be sensitive around dealing with substance abuse, for example, and might set a boundary that she will not start a relationship with someone who drinks or uses drugs. That's a choice each of us is allowed to make. We can decline to enter into a relationship for any reason. This extends to mental health. We have a right to decide whether we will become or remain romantically involved with someone who suffers from depression, anxiety, or any other psychological illness. While the stigma surrounding mental health issues needs to be confronted, and compassion and understanding for people coping with such issues are essential, we are not required to continue to engage in an intimate relationship with someone who suffers from a psychological health problem that may compromise our own well-being. This is each person's own choice to make. When we have these boundaries, however, it is our responsibility to express them, preferably before we have to put someone else's heart on the line. We cannot expect, with this or any other kind of boundary, another person to guess our boundaries. And if we hear about a boundary that we know applies to us, it is also our responsibility to say so, even when it's difficult. Often, mental health issues are surrounded by walls of shame and guilt. They are not easy to talk about. But again, people cannot consent to be in a relationship with us if that consent is not informed. If a prospective partner has expressed a boundary and you don't feel safe sharing your history of mental health issues or substance abuse, that's okay. But it's still ethically necessary to tell that partner, "I don't think we're compatible." We can't, though, guarantee to a partner that we'll never develop mental health issues in the future. When this happens, it is certainly reasonable to ask your partner for help and support. But remember that your romantic partner is not your therapist. Expecting a partner to play that role is likely to place a heavy burden on your partner and the relationship, and unlikely to help you overcome serious issues. Talking to a qualified mental health professional is far more likely to succeed. Having and being able to assert good personal boundaries is a vital prerequisite for the next part of creating frameworks for successful poly relationships. Negotiating agreements and rules. Only by clearly understanding where your own boundaries lie can you hope to work out relationship agreements that meet your needs while still honoring the needs of everyone else involved. Questions to ask yourself. If you aren't sure whether a problem is just a normal bump or points instead to a boundary violation, ask yourself these questions. A yes for any of them is a sign of trouble. Is my partner asking me to give up control of my autonomy, my body, or my emotions? Am I being asked to consent to something in a way that I can't later withdraw my consent? Am I afraid to say I may need to leave this relationship? Am I afraid to say no or to disagree with my partner? Is someone threatening my well-being, safety, or livelihood? Are decisions about my actions or access to my body being made without my involvement or consent? Am I being asked to participate in or be complicit in something I consider dishonest or unethical? Does my partner make me feel worse about myself? Am I being asked to give up relationships with friends or family? Do I feel I have no expectation of privacy in my other relationships? Do I feel that my partner considers me inferior to him or to his other partners? Am I asked to respect my partner or her other partners, but I feel that this respect is not reciprocated? Am I afraid to express my boundaries? Do I feel they won't be respected? Am I treated as just an adjunct to or as an extension of my partner's other relationships, rather than as a person in my own right? 10. Rules and agreements. An intimate relationship is one which neither party silences, sacrifice, or betrays the self, and each party expresses strength and vulnerability, weakness, and competence in a balanced way. Harriet Lerner. One of the first questions people new to poly often ask is what kinds of rules should we have? This is especially true when they are opening an existing relationship. The issue of rules is a complicated, charged topic. Many people have strong feelings about rules in poly relationships. Rules that work, rules that don't. Alternative to rules, distinctions between rules and agreements. These are issues we take carefully apart in the next few chapters. For most people, monogamy comes with a set of expectations and rules bundled in. Some areas aren't necessarily clear. For example, some monogamous couples consider flirting to be a violation of the rules, while others don't. But for the most part, we know the expectations of monogamy. It's tempting, then, to look at the rules that come packaged with monogamy and say, okay, so what rules do we use for polyamory? This approach works for some people, but there are dangers in thinking about relationships in the terms of rules. For instance, we both often hear people say, any rules are okay if you both agree to them. This saying underscores how stubbornly the assumptions of monogamy and couplehood can cling, even in communities that ostensibly practice non-monogamy. It assumes there are only two people, that those two will be negotiating with each other, but not with others, that their needs are of prime importance, that they will call the shots, and that they can make decisions for anyone else who becomes involved with either one of them about the best way to build relationships. The matter is what they both agree to, not what everyone agrees to. We encourage an approach to relationships that gives a voice to all the stakeholders. Many people starting polyamorous relationships also want to know, how can I keep things from changing? And what guarantees do I have that things won't go wrong? Rules are usually an attempt to answer these questions. The answers we offer are, you can't, and you don't have any, and that's okay. Before we go into that, it's helpful to clarify the difference between a rule and an agreement. Rules, agreements, and boundaries are all, at their core, mechanisms for changing behavior. The differences are in how these different things go about doing it, what assumptions they make, how they are created, and whom they apply to. Agreements involve all parties. As we use the word, agreements are negotiated codes of conduct established among people who are involved with each other. An agreement is a covenant negotiated by all parties it affects. Something negotiated between one set of people, a couple, for example, and then presented as a take-it-or-leave-it proposition to the others is not an agreement as we define it. We call that a rule. If Edouard says, I never want you to spend a night with anyone else, and Maria says, okay, this is not an agreement because it affects Maria's other partner, Joseph, who wasn't consulted. If his voice is absent from the negotiations, Edouard and Maria have instituted a rule. Agreements also allow for renegotiation by any of the people they affect. An agreement that does not permit renegotiation is more like a rule. An agreement that is binding on people who did not negotiate it is a rule. Here are some examples of agreements. If one of us wants to spend the night with someone else, we will let the others know in advance so we can discuss it. If one of us wants to have sex with someone else without barriers, we will all first discuss sexual history, risk, and testing before we reach a decision. We will immediately talk about a situation that makes us feel threatened, rather than sitting on it. We will not start new relationships while there are problems in our existing relationships. We will negotiate safer sex boundaries with each of our new partners. We will make our sexual health information available to new partners who want it. Even when the negotiations include all parties, you must still take care to make the negotiations equitable for everyone. Power in a relationship is almost never distributed equally. When a new person starts a relationship with one or more people who are already together, the newcomer will probably have less power than they do. He is likely to bear the brunt of their disagreements or any resentments they have between each other. In an ethical negotiation, any person with a disproportionate amount of power must negotiate compassionately, rather than using that power to browbeat others to consensus. Rules place restrictions without negotiation. As the term is used in this book, rules are binding limitations placed on someone's behavior that are not up for negotiation. Even when a rule is agreed to, it's a mandate that can only be obeyed or broken. Breaking a rule is assumed to have consequences, such as loss of the relationship. Agreements sometimes become rules. The defining element of a rule is a restriction placed on someone without their input or negotiation. A trivial example of a rule is that Eve and Peter don't permit shoes to be worn in their home. Everyone visiting must follow it. The consequence of breaking it is that you will probably not be invited back. Some examples of poly rules we've seen people using or trying to use are: we will never spend the night at another lover's house. We will always come home at night. We will always use barriers when one of us has sex with another lover. We will not refer to any other partner by the same pet names we use with each other. We can have sex with other people, but we won't love another person as much as or more than we love each other. We will not bring any other lover to our favorite restaurant. If one of us wants the other to break up with another partner, we will do it. This is called a veto and is described in chapter 12. We will not have sex with other partners in certain sexual positions or if the other is not there. We will only start relationship with people who are willing to be in a relationship with both or all of us. We will only start relationships with people who are willing to be exclusive to both or all of us. These rules may sound a lot like the agreements listed in the previous section. They all start with we. The difference is that all of the rules listed here materially affect a third person who did not have a role in negotiating them, and that person must accept them or leave the relationship or relationships. The absence or presence of empowerment is a litmus test for whether something is a rule or an agreement. Are all the people affected empowered to make their objections heard? Will the others consider the objection seriously? Or will some people's objections always be overruled? What happens if someone wants a structure that doesn't work for someone else? Are negotiation and compromise possible? Or is leaving the only alternative? Agreements empower people, whereas rules enforce power imbalances. On a practical level, it is not always possible to make another person feel empowered. Indeed, we have noticed on many occasions that it's the person who feels disempowered who insists on rules, and then sees attempts to negotiate or modify the rules as further evidence of disempowerment. Feelings are not always congruent with reality. Neither of us has met anyone who makes up rules by rolling dice or drawing words out of a hat. A rule is made to solve a problem or meet a need. However, making rules can quickly become complicated, because it's very easy to confuse needs with feelings. A person who says, "I don't want you to ever spend the night with another lover," might think the rule serves a need, such as, "I need to wake up with you in the morning." But if we examine that need, it may come down to, "I feel lonely if I wake up by myself." The rule is meant to prevent triggering a negative feeling, in this case, a feeling of loneliness. The actual issue, "I feel lonely when I wake up alone," is not being directly addressed. Leading with the need, "How can we help make sure I understand how valued I am by you," rather than the actions, opens the door to finding ways to solve the problem without imposing rules. How agreements become rules. When someone talks about why they need a rule, they tell you something about their fears. So it's not surprising that agreements become rules when they are grounded in fear. It often goes like this. People in a relationship, often a couple, sit down and negotiate a set of relationship agreements. At this point, there aren't any new partners, so the people negotiating the agreements rarely consider the effects their agreements will have on others. Then a new person comes along. The partners present the new person with the agreement, with the expectation that the new person will sign on. She has little investment in the relationship at this point, and may be inexperienced with polyamory and unfamiliar with any other models of it. So, she agrees. After a time, one or more of the original people experience some sort of insecurity or feel threatened. The newer person is blamed for violating the agreement. Sometimes a subtle, creative interpretation of it. The existing partners either end the relationship with the newer person over this infraction, or use the infraction to justify imposing greater restrictions. Well, she agreed to it, right? What gives her the right to complain now? When things go wrong, when an agreement is hurting someone, or isn't having the intended effect, and needs to be renegotiated, saying, "But you agreed to this," is just twisting the knife, and never helps solve the problem. At the beginning of a relationship, we are not yet emotionally invested in it, and we don't know how it will progress, so it can become easy to accept rules or agreements that later, as we become more vulnerable and more emotionally invested, become quite painful. Here is Franklin's story.
I had an agreement with my wife, Celeste, that no other partner would live with us. This agreement was presented to all of my new partners, including Bella and Amber. They both agreed to it, and why not? At the start of dating someone, living together often seems vague and remote. So they agreed easily. There was no emotional investment yet, no pull toward a shared life. The prohibition on living together didn't become a source of pain until much later, in Bella's case, years later. Once we had built a deep, loving relationship, that pull toward a shared life began, and the agreement I had with Celeste left no room for that. The fact that Bella and Amber had signed on to this restriction up front did not change the fact that they were not allowed to express their needs when the nature of the relationship between us changed. Bella was never allowed to renegotiate this agreement, and our relationship suffered because of it. Eventually, it ended. After 10 years of trying to remain within the constraints of my agreement with Celeste, Bella found it simply too painful to remain with me. The truth, which we never acknowledged directly, was that my agreement with Celeste had less to do with sharing a roof than with preventing certain types of relationships. My relationship with Bella was painful and crippled because the real, unspoken intent of the relationships, the reason these agreements were important to Celeste, she didn't want me in a relationship of such depth and significance that I wanted to live with another partner. The agreements achieved covertly what a direct statement could not do overtly. They created an environment so inflexible, so hostile to intimacy, that close, intimate relationships would suffer.
Rules that new partners are expected to sign on to, but which have little or no say in, rarely provide space for new relationships to grow. Sometimes these rules are deliberately designed to keep new relationships away from sunlight and water, forcing them to remain stunted or to wither away altogether. It's not possible to ever feel completely secure in a relationship whose structures are built on fear, even if you follow all the rules, or the rules are easy for you. At some level, you will always be aware that another person's potential fears are a driving force in the relationship. If the day comes when that person is afraid of you, look out. In extreme cases, rules can become tools of emotional blackmail. They constitute a contract that specifies acts of betrayal, and a person who breaks a rule is cast in the role of villain. Rules-based systems judge people's characters on the basis of adherence to the rules. When rules are used as a tool with which to attack someone's character, especially when the attacks are based on creative interpretations of the rules, they become a nearly invisible but extremely corrosive form of emotional abuse. Alternatives to rules. Some of Franklin's most controversial and popular blog posts concern what he calls rules-based relationships. His skepticism about rules has led a lot of people to believe that he opposes them altogether. So we want to make clear that when we talk about relationships that are not rules-based, we're not talking about relationships with no rules whatever. Rather, we're talking about relationships that don't use rules as the first go-to problem-solving tactic, and which don't attempt to deal with emotional or security issues by creating frameworks of rules. Many people say, "I need rules in my relationship," but when they're asked why, it quickly becomes obvious that what they need is actually something else. It is usually something like security or stability, a sense of empowerment, predictability, or safety. Those are all reasonable needs. What's not obvious is that it's possible to have those things without rules. Conflating rules with needs is common, because we live in societies that teach us we need external structures and authority in order to act like civilized people. Many of us internalize the idea that the only way we can rely on people to behave with kindness, responsibility, respect, and compassion is to create rigid codes compelling them to. We believe that if people make choices from personal autonomy, then responsibilities will be neglected and kindness will fade. In reality, relationships without rules are usually far from a madhouse in which everyone does whatever they want without regard for anyone else. Instead, if you look at such relationships, they tend to show very high levels of communication, negotiation, compassion, and understanding. Does this surprise you? We often think of rules and commitment as being almost interchangeable. We demonstrate commitment by agreeing to rules that limit our behavior. From that position, it can be hard to imagine what a relationship without rules would even look like, except perhaps a free-for-all. Relationships, especially cohabiting relationships, often involve many commitments and responsibilities. One might think, how can I be sure the kid will be picked up from school if I don't have a rule telling my partner to be home by 3:30 on weekdays? If there's no rule against late-night dates, how do I know my partner will be able to get up in the morning to go to work? And the answer is, you don't. But if a partner is willing to skip out on commitments and responsibilities, she's probably just as willing to break rules. To understand relationships that are not rules-based, we need to go back to two of the themes we emphasize in this book, trust and boundaries. You have to trust that your partners want to take care of you, that given freedom to do whatever they choose, they will make choices that respect your needs and honor their commitments. Placing that level of trust in someone can be scary. Rules can feel safer, but they're not. And they hide the real concerns. Talking about the things I need can feel scary and vulnerable. It's easier to say, I want you to be home every night before midnight, than to say, I feel lonely when I wake up in an empty bed without you. How can we work together to deal with that? Polyblogger Andrea Zanin has said, rules have an inverse relationship to trust. They are intended to bind someone to someone else's preferences. They are aimed at constraint. I will limit you, and you will limit me, and then we'll both be safe. The problem with rules, though, is we can never actually force our partners to abide by them. A partner who can't be trusted to meet your needs can't be trusted to follow your rules. What you need is a trustworthy partner, and you need to be trustworthy yourself. Sometimes rules try to compensate for poor boundaries. We've talked to many people who say that they use rules to prevent drama or to protect themselves from someone who might want to split them up. We believe such rules aren't necessary if we know, have, and assert good boundaries. Nobody can make you and your partner split up or engage you in drama if you don't agree to it. If you can simply say, no, I won't participate in this dynamic, or I choose to remain with my partner, I'm not interested in dissolving this relationship, then you don't need to rely on structures or rules to attempt to do that for you. In the end, whether you choose to rely on putting in place rules or agreements, or simply advocating for your needs and giving your partners the opportunity to address them, no relationship will succeed if your partners don't want to invest in it. If they cannot be trusted to make the relationship work, it won't. Rules be damned. Rules as training wheels. Another common idea in the poly community is the notion of rules as training wheels, a way to learn the skills to navigate poly relationships without feeling threatened. A person, or more often a couple, may start out with a list of highly restrictive rules, thinking they will learn trust by seeing other people obey the restrictions. Then, once that trust has been built, the rules can slowly be relaxed. This idea may have become popular from the observation that lots of successful poly relationships seem to have grown this way. Couple or group will sometimes start out drawing up a long, detailed relationship agreement with many pages of rules and specifications. And then, as it's renegotiated over time, it becomes ever simpler and more general, until perhaps a 10-page document has been condensed to something like, use good judgment, be thoughtful, take responsibility, don't be a dick. The group's success makes this strategy look a winner, and they proudly blog about it. In fact, we believe the popularity of this idea confuses cause and effect. Because they were thoughtful people who take responsibility, they didn't need 10 pages of rules in the first place. And if they hadn't been thoughtful people, the rules wouldn't have helped. Training wheels, rules, are a seductive idea. They offer a justification for a tightly restricted model of poly, but also offer the promise that someday they won't be necessary. We have even been told that empowered poly relationships are only an option for people who already have lots of poly experience or a secure attachment style. Everyone else starting out is supposed to need the comfort of rules to learn the trust that leads to poly enlightenment. The biggest problem with the training wheels metaphor is that it treats people as things. In the case of a couple, they're telling new partners, we don't really trust you, and we don't have the skills to treat you well, so we're going to use you as practice to learn how to treat our future partners well. The idea is, if you don't trust your partner, the way to gain trust is to restrict her and anyone else she is involved with. But not everyone learns to ride a bike by using training wheels. Some people even believe that relying on training wheels teaches bad habits that must be unlearned when the training wheels come off. In polyamorous relationships, using rules to avoid dealing with thorny problems like jealousy and insecurity can cause us to learn some very bad relationship habits indeed. Even under the best of circumstances, talking about our fears and insecurities is hard. When we talk about our frailties, we become exposed and vulnerable, and that is uncomfortable. Relying on rules to deal with these feelings teaches us that we don't have to talk about them, which prevents us from learning the skills we need to find lasting solutions. The entire purpose of many relationship rules is risk avoidance. If we already have a relationship when we start exploring polyamory, it's natural to say, I would like to protect the relationship I already have, so I want to explore polyamory without risk. If we come to Polly when we're single, it's natural to say, I want to protect my heart. So when I have a partner, I will ask her not to do anything that makes me feel threatened. Unfortunately, when you seek to reduce risk by imposing constraints on other people's behavior, you transfer that risk onto others. By doing this, you say, I want to explore polyamory, but I don't want to take this risk, so I will transfer it onto any new partners by asking them to be open and vulnerable while also limiting how much they're allowed to advocate for their own needs. We feel that doing this is a form of treating people as things. We know we're expecting a great deal of courage by suggesting that you start exploring polyamory without relying on rules to feel safe. It does seem that the secret to a healthy, dynamic relationship keeps coming back to courage. Forget training wheels. Forget trying to figure out the right rules that would keep you safe forever. There is no safe forever. Instead, go into the world seeking to treat others with compassion whenever you touch them. Try to leave people better than when you found them. Communicate your needs, understand and advocate for your boundaries, and look for other people who will do the same. Trust them when they say they love you. Where communication and compassion exist, you don't need rules to keep you safe. We don't learn how to be compassionate by disenfranchising other people. We learn how to be compassionate by practicing compassion. Limited duration rules. Sometimes a rule can be useful, even necessary. When you're up to your ass in alligators, sometimes you just need the alligators off your ass for a while. We recognize that the work it takes to become secure and confident is hard. In some situations, rules that are specific, narrow in scope, and, most importantly, limited in duration, can be valuable tools for problem solving. If you found that something your partners are doing just absolutely drives you crazy, asking them to temporarily stop doing it can give you the emotional space to process whatever's underneath. Eve's story.
When I first started dating Ray, Peter and I had extremely strict boundaries around sexual health, which included barriers for giving and receiving oral sex. After a couple of months, and after Ray and I had exchanged STI test results, I wanted to stop using barriers for oral sex, but Peter didn't feel safe about it. I did my research and was able to give Peter what I believed were reliable sources showing how low the risk was that I would catch anything from Ray during those activities, but Peter was still uncomfortable. He confessed that his discomfort was with the emotional implications of me and Ray having unprotected oral sex. I agreed to continue using barriers with Ray, as long as Peter agreed to work on his emotional blockage around the issue. We agreed to revisit the agreement in 2 weeks. 2 weeks later, we sat down again to talk about it. Peter said he had worked through his discomfort with me having that kind of sex with Ray, and our relationship proceeded.
Implementing time-limited rules can be helpful in specific situations, but there's also a risk in doing so. When we're comfortable, we tend to want to stay there. That's why we recommend a sunset clause to any rule, a way to say, after 3 weeks or some other time period, we will revisit this issue. And it goes on the calendar. How much time? That depends on the circumstances and the people, but broadly, for most people, a week is too short and a year is too long. A sunset clause doesn't mean you're under a deadline to fix the emotional issue. It's merely a promise to re-examine and renegotiate. You're asking your partners to trust that you are willing to work on whatever the underlying problem is. You're asking your partners to trust that you won't simply keep extending the rule every 3 weeks into infinity. Your partners are asking you to trust that they genuinely want to help support you in fixing the issue, and that they are willing to give you the space while you're working on it. Do the rules serve the people? It's incredibly easy to fall into prioritizing the rules of a relationship over the happiness of the people involved. We believe it's important to remember the ethical axiom that people in the relationship are more important than the relationship. Sacrificing the happiness of human beings in the service of rules, rather than making rules that serve the needs of the people, takes us further away from joyful, fulfilling lives, not closer to them. Here is Franklin's story.
Celeste and I negotiated rules that placed tight restrictions on me and my partners. Even when I became aware that these restrictions were not benefiting our relationship, I held on to the idea that I should honor my commitments above all else, even at the expense of my happiness. Only years later did I start to realize how much these restrictions were hurting not just me, but also my other partners. It was easy to tell myself that I was doing the right thing by saying, I will honor my commitments over my own needs. This gave me a sense of noble sacrifice. I loved Celeste so much, I was willing to give up my happiness for her. However, as years went by, doing this became harder when I saw that I was hurting other people, too. Dismissing their pain by saying, it's okay, I'm honoring my commitments, started to feel unethical. When my relationship with Celeste ended, we both became happier. We found relationships that were more aligned with what we wanted. In the end, my stubborn insistence on honoring my commitments without renegotiation deprived her of happiness, too. Things ran off the rails when I started to believe I was subordinate to the needs of the commitments rather than focusing on building commitments that served my needs and the needs of all the people I loved. When I made myself subordinate to the rules, it didn't make anyone happy, not me, not Celeste, and certainly not my other partners who ended up in harm's way because of it.
Reevaluating agreements. Anyone should be able to reopen discussions about an agreement at any time. It helps to think of agreements as mutable, organic things that will be revisited and modified as people grow and relationships change. When we see these structures as static, they can make relationships less rather than more stable, because they will fail to adapt to change, sometimes spectacularly. A good relationship is not something you have, it's something you do, over and over. The best, happiest relationships we have seen and been involved in are those who the members are constantly willing to renegotiate the groundwork beneath them. In fact, some people set periodic dates in their calendar when they will review their relationship agreements with each other to make sure they're still working and see if anything needs to change. Both of us have experience with renegotiating our long-term relationships. Eve tells three stories in this book about renegotiating her relationship with her husband, Peter. Franklin describes doing so with Amber. These are lifelong partnerships that have endured because they were able to adapt to the changing circumstances around them and the changing people within them. When looking at the structures of your relationship, ask yourself regularly, are they honest? Are they necessary? Are they kind? Are they respectful? Are they considerate of others? If you've made agreements with an existing partner that you expect new partners to abide by, ask yourself, would I have become involved with my current partner if I were bound by these agreements at the start? Creeping concessions. Flexibility and willingness to renegotiate agreements are vital parts of a growing, thriving polyamorous relationship. There's a potential danger lurking in this flexibility, though, which we will call creeping concessions. For example, neither one of us will ever enter a relationship with someone who has or wants a veto arrangement. That's a boundary. But sometimes people can end up in relationships that cross boundaries without their even noticing it. Perhaps you have a partner who's having difficulty and asks you to give up something while he works through his issue. You naturally want to support your partners, so you agree. Later, that person may say, well, this still isn't working. Dreadfully sorry, but can you give up a little more? I'm really struggling with this. Because our partner's happiness is important to you, you say, yes. And perhaps time goes by and your partner says, look, I'm terribly sorry to bring this up, but I'm still having issues here. Can you perhaps find it in your heart to make this other small concession over here? Just one little thing. It will really help me. Bit by bit, inch by inch, you may find yourself negotiating away things that are important. If each individual step is small enough, you might give up a boundary without even seeing it. At times, we may be aware that we're conceding things we once thought inviolate, but we do it anyway because we've already invested so much. Economists have a name for this, the sunk cost of fallacy. A sunk cost is an investment of time, energy, attention, or something else that can't be recovered. If you spend a year in a relationship that isn't a good fit for you, you can't go back and get that year back again. The fallacy part involves making decisions for the future based on that past investment, rather than on whether the decisions are likely to benefit you in the future. Say, for example, you've bought tickets to a movie, and you realize early into the movie that you're not going to enjoy it. You've already bought the tickets, and you can't get your money back. Do you stay and watch the movie and have a miserable time? Or do you walk out and browse the bookstore, which is much more enjoyable? It's hard to walk away from the movie, although the cost of the tickets is gone either way. When you're deciding whether to agree to a compromise or concession that gives you a sick feeling, knowing that the alternative might be the end to the relationship, you might think, I've invested a year of my life in this relationship. I can't let it go. Rather than, this relationship is not working. And if I make this concession, it's going to work even less. It's better to choose whether to agree based on my future happiness, not on the year I've already spent. Agreements about privacy and disclosure. We've talked a lot about how open, honest communication is, in our experience, absolutely essential to polyamory. However, we all have the right to set boundaries around access to our bodies and our emotions. One of those boundaries concerns privacy. The right to privacy is often considered a basic human right. Balancing the need for disclosure with a reasonable expectation of privacy is not always easy. There is no bright line where one stops and the other starts. Rules that mandate either disclosure or secrecy can make sense. For example, communication about sexual boundaries and sexual health is necessary to give informed consent, and a rule that text messages will be kept private protects the intimacy and trust of partners. But it can be easy to go to the extremes and create rules that violate someone's right to privacy or consent. For example, as I mentioned in the previous chapter, under sudden left turns, someone once emailed Franklin to say her husband wanted to see every single communication, such as texts and emails, between her and her boyfriend. Most of us would probably agree this is a serious violation of her boyfriend's privacy. It is difficult for intimacy to grow under the eye of an outside observer. We all need private spaces if we are to reveal a lover the deepest parts of ourselves, the furthest corners of our hearts, and especially the wounded and vulnerable places within ourselves. Compulsory sharing is always a bit suspect. When others demand that we reveal ourselves, intimacy is undermined rather than strengthened, because something that is demanded cannot be shared freely as a gift. Intimacy is built by mutual consensual sharing, not by demands. At the other extreme, some people insist on knowing absolutely nothing about a partner's other lovers. Not even how many, not even their names. These don't ask, don't tell relationships raise troubling questions about boundaries, consent, and